So, where are you from, and how did it all begin?
I'm actually from Massachusetts. I was raised there, educated there, and I really was. I'm a native son of Massachusetts, and around about 1962, I started getting worried about my future. I graduated in 63 from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and I think that probably the turning point in my life was joining the Peace Corps. I joined the Peace Corps in 63 and went to Central Africa to a place called Nyasaland, which is now called Malawi. And really from then until now, I've been living more or less outside the States. I come back a lot. I own a house in Massachusetts. But after I left the Peace Corps, I went to Uganda. And then I taught in Africa altogether for 5.5 years. And I went to Southeast Asia. I was in Singapore, traveled around Indonesia, Burma, Thailand. Then I went to England. After that, I gave up teaching because I had been teaching for 9 years in these sort of equatorial outposts.
And teaching what?
I was teaching English, language and literature. Depends on the place. In Africa, it was mostly language and low-level literature courses. In Singapore, it was quite high-level, you know, Shakespeare and his contemporaries, Jacobean drama, stuff like that, to Chinese students who eventually decided they couldn't live. I was sort of over-educated for Singapore. I went to Australia, came to the States. I mean, I began to think that the teaching overseas wasn't all it was cracked up to be. It was very good for me, but I thought in the end, actually, I went to my Peace Corps reunion about a month ago, and on my way there, I was reflecting on this and thinking, it was wonderful for me, the Peace Corps, teaching abroad. It couldn't have been better. I did nothing but profit by it. But I think we probably didn't do any good at all to the countries that we were in. I think we might have even done some harm. We certainly made the people very impatient and incapable of coping with their lives. I mean, I think it would have been better being a dentist in Africa or showing people how to grow corn or something.
You have a rather literary family, don't you? Tell me about that.
Yes, I have two brothers who write. And I'm one of seven children. And the others read. I mean, I consider being literary, being bookish, writing and reading. My younger brother, Joseph, has just published a novel. My brother Alex, who's 2 years older than me, has published about 5 books. And most recently, a very long, very interesting book called Darkinville's Cat.
Is there any competition within the family in terms of literary goals?
No, there is no competition, because I think in general, as far as writing is concerned, there is never any competition. It's one of the most non-competitive or uncompetitive fields that anyone can go into. It may be the only profession or the only business that you can be in where you have no competitors. You're actually only competing with yourself, because no one writes the way you do. No one thinks the way you do. No one has your imagination, ambition, or skill. They have their own. You have your own. And you're limited entirely by your imagination. Of course, sometimes people compete in terms of sales, books, money. But that's irrelevant to writing. Because you're writing your own book. You're doing. I mean, it's just, I suppose there's no competition in painting. In most creative things, there's none. I mean, when you get right down to it, there's nothing there. So that you're entirely on your own.
Why have you chosen to live out of the United States?
Originally, I joined the Peace Corps so that I wouldn't be sent to Vietnam. And then I went to Vietnam in 73 and wished that I had gone. I mean, I went there as a journalist and wished I had gone in some capacity. I didn't want to get killed, but I was I was very much against the war in 63, violently against the war. And against being drafted, but I thought that I should do some sort of alternative service. Then when I stayed away, I thought I had a perspective on my own life and on the States, and I began to understand the United States much better and wanted to come back. I mean, I'm very proud of being American, and I feel I have roots here and so forth, but I suppose my basic reason for staying, my reason for going was to avoid being drafted, of course, and being killed in the war. Or being forced into a position of taking orders, doing something that I didn't believe in, that was against my conscience. But I think that I stayed away merely out of curiosity, and because I thought that in your early and middle years, while you're still strong and able to do it, you should see what the world is, because I don't want to be an elderly traveler. I don't want to be the sort of person who is arthritic and climbing Machu Picchu, you know, or being wheeled down the Yangtze on a, you know, in a wheelchair. I want to see it while I can walk around, have a drink, and, you know, and be active. I think I'll probably be, you know, end my life in some very sedate place. But in the meantime, while I have the strength and ambition, I'm willing to take risks.
What kind of life do you have in England now? Are you living in London?
I live in London and also in Massachusetts. I sort of divide my time. But I live, when I'm in London, I suppose, a very sedentary sort of life. The sort of life that any writer leads is very chair-bound, I think, because you're tied very much to certain hours, to your desk, your typewriter. And it's neutral territory until you finish your work. When I finish my work, then I feel like going, and usually feel like going very far away.
No longer teaching?
No, I haven't actually taught for about 12 years, more, I think, than 12 years, because teaching was interfering with my writing, and also I began to get to the point where I wasn't learning anything from the students, and the students weren't giving me anything. For about 9 or 10 years, it was very interesting. I actually felt I was learning something from them. Then it became very repetitive. I always feared going into a job for that reason. For example, I thought I might be a very good doctor or dentist, and I thought, well, maybe dentistry, let's say, would, after about 10 or 15 years, might get very boring. I think it would be. I mean, I wonder why people pursue certain jobs and not others, why people actually don't change jobs. I know a man who was stockbroker and gave up stockbroking to build boats, wooden boats. Rowboats mainly, and sailboats. I knew about this man, say, 20 years ago, and didn't understand him. Now that I'm 42, I understand perfectly why anyone would leave the world of stockbroking to build boats.
I want to get to the Kingdom by the Sea in a moment, but first, just to go back a ways, how did your first book come about? When was that?
My first book was, I had been working on books and writing from a very early age. From the time that I began to read intelligently, I think. So let's say 15 or 16. I had been writing stories, then books. So when I was in college, I wrote a lot. I actually was working on modest, you know, short novels. So my first book, my first three books were never published, but they weren't very good. I think my first book, which is called Waldo, is not a very good book, but it was published in 1967. It was published in the conventional way. I didn't have an agent. I had written this book. I was in Africa. I sent it to a publisher. They read it, liked it, and published it. And then I got reviewed, and it was well reviewed. It was actually very generously reviewed. As first novels often are, people are very gentle and generous, and they say, this is a good book, and we hope, you know, he'll write us another one. Now I know that they were probably saying, write us a better one. But it was very, a very good thing. Nothing actually can recapture the pleasure of a first novel being published, or being accepted, I think. Because I think the pleasure of having finished a book and then having it accepted is wonderful. I suppose being published is a slight anticlimax to finishing an acceptance. But anyway, that was my first book. And I've published one or two books every year since then.
Opened up the floodgates.
What it did was it convinced me that a book isn't enough, and that when you've written a book, there's something behind it. I mean, one book really does produce another. It inspires another with me. I'm not a sort of Herman Melville major novel. Oh, I don't know, maybe there are other better examples, Thomas Wolfe type, who write major novels, huge elephantine books. Mine, I think, are more modest in scope. They're large. I mean, The Mosquito Coast was quite a long book. Paris to Travel with the Great Railway Bazaar was a long book. I see myself as writing in a series, producing one book after another, rather than breathing all my creative energy, whatever that may be, into a single book or two books. You know, Ralph Ellison wrote Invisible Man. So I think it is a major book and a wonderful one, but has not done much since. And so there's a tradition in the States for a person to build a reputation on one book rather than several or a dozen or two dozen, which is what I'm getting to at the moment.
We have some time constraints, so I want to go on to Kingdom by the Sea, which I thought was a marvelous book. You certainly write well. I jotted down a few notes as I read, and one of the things that you do extremely well, you pick up sounds and odors. For example, you describe the smell of dirt and wood smoke, furniture wax and hot bread in a village, or mice and unwashed clothes in a room, or in a dining room, bacon and beer. That's very good. I assume that you notice these things as you go around in a much more vivid way than most of us. We just go and we look and it's there, but you have this perception that that seems to transcend the average person's viewpoint.
Well, I think that I've tried very hard to convey not the look of a place, but the smell of a place. And sometimes it's not that pleasant, but I'm not gratuitously trying to offend people. I think that the tradition of the travel book is interesting, and there are lots of different kinds. There are the travel books that tell you how to get to a place, what to do there, and then how to get home. I've always felt that probably the best travel book is one that does that, but does a bit more, that takes the place of travel. So that if a person really doesn't want to go to a place, but wants to find out about a place, he reads the book and ought to feel that he's been there, so that the travel writer is doing the traveling for the reader, so that there really is a sense of being an armchair traveler. I also think that travel isn't a vacation. The idea of the heightened perception of a smell or the look of a place is more keenly felt where it's no holiday. You're not lying on your back on the beach. It's not a kind of horizontal vacation. It's not come to sunny Barbados. It's actually maybe backpacking along fairly rainy coasts, as it was with me. You see, in the Kingdom by the Sea, I didn't go to Windsor Castle, Stonehenge, the sights. I didn't see the crown jewels. This isn't a book about sightseeing. It really is travel in the old traditional sense, which is going from place to place, seeing what people do, what the place looks like, what it smells like, what they talk about, what they complain about, and putting in, you know, the good, the bad, the indifferent. I'm not trying to sell anyone a vacation.
In fact, Douglas Edwards, who has written a series called The Hitchhiker's Guide, Hitchhiker series, I don't know, they're science fiction satire. He was in for an interview a week or two ago, and he had read The Kingdom by the Sea. He lives in London. And he said, it's so depressing. He said, are we British really like that?
Yeah.
And indeed.
They are. The British really are like that. They don't want to be like that. They wish they weren't like that. But no one has ever written about them in the way they really are. We always accept the British at their own valuation. We accept the British class system. We're impressed by British snobbery, which is a vile thing, and the idea that someone should look down on someone for either his origins or his accent or the lack of money or something like that. So we tend to accept. I don't know why this is so. The British laugh at Indians. They laugh at Brazilians. They've written about Africans. They write about South Americans. And we accept all of that. But they never write about themselves, and they don't really invite anyone to see them as foreigners in the way that they've seen everyone else. In fact, they have a stereotype image of Americans which is not flattering and not even truthful. So what I tried to do in the book was actually present the truthful, warts and all image of them. It's a very strange, I know it's a strange image, because it's like seeing, it's almost as if the mirror has never been held up to them, and they don't like what they've seen, because the last perception they had of themselves was a pre-war perception, or a kind of brave fighting people going down to various plucky defeats, you know, victorious in defeat, indomitable, dauntless. They're not like that. I mean, it's a country which is essentially a cultural failure.
You have made the British both likable and unlikable. You quote them as using casually terms such as nigger and Jew boy.
They say that, yes. Yeah.
I don't know how they can get away with it.
It's very easy to get away with any kind of prejudice in England because first they can say, well, that's the way we are. You shouldn't take us seriously. Or secondly, that they don't mean it. And that basically they're a very tolerant people. Well, I think that they are a tolerant people. But they do, I mean, the English, as opposed to the Welsh, the Irish, or the Scots, regard non-English people as foreigners and laughable. But they don't, they are a sense, like all people who have a notion of superiority, they also have severe doubts about it. I mean, it's, you can't be prejudiced against someone without feeling that you are basically inferior yourself. They always say that a murderer is always his victim's inferior. The man who kills is always worse than the victim. And the English are usually much worse than the people they despise. But I don't think that they themselves are despicable. I think that they're very complicated and worth studying. But you can only understand the British by treating them as anthropological specimens, as natives, in the way that they treated everyone else as natives. I mean, the curious poetic justice of this book is that it's a mild version of a book that Dickens wrote in the middle of the 19th century called American Notes, where he came, and it was a fun-poking book mainly, but it was devastatingly devastating mockery of America.
There also is a sense of violence that I felt in some parts of your book about Britain that I hadn't felt before. There is one vignette that you have in which you're walking through the woods and you come across a young woman a day or two after two women had been murdered nearby in those woods. And then some of the newspaper headlines that you have picked up as you traveled the coastline made references to murders and this sort of thing. And yet our perception from here is that Britain is a very gentle, non-violent country, with the exception, of course, of Ulster. But this is wrong, too.
Ulster is Britain, though, and Ulster is a very violent place. I don't think of Britain as a particularly violent place, but it has violence in it. I think it's impossible to live a British life and not be violent, because so much goes wrong. There's so many thwarted ambitions. So much could happen. To be British is really to watch things improving for everyone else and not for yourself. And this is why they're natural emigrants. I mean, when they go to another country, they stay. When a British person earns a lot of money, he tends to leave. He goes to a tax haven. He comes to the States. He goes to Monte Carlo. He goes to France, where the tax rate is low. He might go to Ireland, if he's a writer, and where there's no tax. The idea of making money and paying tax on it in Britain is almost unheard of. The wealthy families, it was revealed not too long ago, don't pay much tax. They have various loopholes. So there's a lot of aggression, there's a lot of resentment, and a tremendous amount of envy. There's even a whole system whereby if a person has a Rolls Royce, and I was told this by my accountant, who has many more prosperous people than me on his books, and he said that a person buys a big car, a Rolls Royce, a Jaguar or something, and parks it on the street, he'll probably find that his antenna is twisted off or there's a scratch on it. But the scratches on a Rolls Royce are called envy marks. So there are people who merely scratch a car out of envy. It's not to destroy, it's merely to leave a kind of calling card, which is a mark of resentment. That's different from stealing the car. I think car theft is a very rare thing in Britain. But envy marks, very common.
There are other depressing aspects, too. You write about the old people who drive to the coastline and sit in their cars.
Yes, that's a very curious thing. The idea of people merely passing the time by sitting in a car, staring at the sea. I think that it's bound up with the English notion of the sea as a very peaceful thing. The sea is restful. You look out and it... Elias Canetti, the Nobel Prize winner of 2 years ago, described the national crowd symbol of the British as the sea, all the waves like a crown. He said the forest is the German one. Germans think of themselves as a tremendous relation of themselves to the forest and trees. The trees like a marching army. And I mean, it's quite interesting. Some nations see themselves as bound up with fire. Fire is a crowd symbol. Looks like a crowd of people. Fire, little flames sticking out. And so the waves are too. It's consoling. Seems to hide multitudes of things, but it's a very peaceful thing. And it's I think the image that I carry away after going 7,000 miles around the British coast is of elderly English people sitting there with their backs to the land, looking out to sea, almost as if they're looking into eternity. And I don't think that's too metaphysical a way of putting it, although one can always be wrong. Once D.H. Lawrence was in Mexico, and he saw people, and he said these Mexicans with dark, liquid eyes sitting by the side of the road, looking as if they were waiting for eternity. What he didn't know is they were waiting for a bus.
What was it like for you? How did you feel, knowing that you were American and that they knew you were an American as you went along the coastline with your backpack?
Well, the English are very ambivalent about Americans. I mean, they admire us tremendously. They also feel very much in our shadow. Two or three days ago, around the time of the Grenada invasion, a British MP got up and described President Reagan as a dangerous cretin with a cabinet full of businessmen, and there was kind of mocking laughter. But they're frightened. They're frightened of America as a power. They're frightened of nuclear missiles. You know, the cruise missiles that are being sighted in Britain. But they also feel that their backs are to the wall. That you, although they call themselves Europeans, they are not Europeans. And so they want to be an ally of ours, but they don't want to be lackeys. So they meet an American and they see someone who they think is probably wealthy, probably better educated than they are, because very few British people go to college. You go to, I mean, conventionally, even an intelligent boy would go, or girl would go to up to the sixth form, and then, which is the equivalent of, say, the first or second year of junior college, and then out and get a job, be an apprentice. University is something for a strict minority of people, and there are very few private universities in Britain. Anyway, they see an American, and they have a lot of complicated feelings. Envy, guilt, gratitude for two wars in which we came over and joined forces. All these complicated feelings. And they remember all the good things. Also, they're great consumers of American culture. They watch Dallas. They like Frank Sinatra. They like Bing Crosby. They love Fred Astaire. You know, and they think, my God, here's this person. They want to talk about things. What's Kansas City like? Is California really sunny?
They want to talk about things. You did not have any difficulty, apparently, with the dialogue in your book, striking up conversations.
On the whole, the English would rather talk about neutral things. They don't want to reveal themselves. I mean, one of the difficulties about the class system is that as soon as a person opens his mouth, he reveals his class. And you might, and this is why the English don't talk to strangers, because they're afraid. They want to be friendly. They want to say hello, but they're afraid that the person won't say hello back, or will despise them when they say, you know, morning, governor, morning, gov.
I had more questions. I made a whole list, but
oh, well, that's too bad. I mean, I don't mind if you've got an important one down there.
I was going to cover some things about Ulster, but I'm just...
Ulster's a touchy subject. I did try to deal with it.
I wondered a little bit why you included it, because somehow I don't perceive Ulster as part of Britain. I see it as... See, you kept calling it Ulster, and I perceive it as Northern Ireland.
Well, it is Northern Ireland, and it will be Northern Ireland one day, but... For the moment, it's British. It's a British offshore territory. They have the welfare system. They have, National Health Service. Everything. It's a British community that part of it wants to be British and part of it, of course, doesn't. I wanted to deal with it as a factor in British life, because everyone talks about it and no one knows what to do. And I want in this book, I wanted to go to all the places that I had been hearing about for all these years.
There must be some reaction in Britain to your book. What has it been up to this point?
It's a bestseller in a very grudging sort of way. It's selling extremely well, but I've got some of the most savage reviews I've ever got in my life, and some of the most severe cases of apoplexy.
Thank you very much.